Okay, let's get started. We'll pick it up where we left off. We had started into the Sermon on the Mount. We had talked about the background of the Sermon on the Mount. We went through the Beatitudes, and we started on page 26, so we'll pick up there. And I want to do a little bit of recap. There was something I intended to bring with me last time and forgot, and this is to illustrate what Jesus Christ is talking about when he talks about the light of the world. This is a lamp of the type that would have been used in first century Judea. So when Jesus talks about verse 14 of Matthew 5, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. This is what he was talking about. This is kind of the flashlight of the day. These are very common, and the way it worked is these were filled with olive oil. Olive oil had many uses at that time. It was a very valuable commodity. The oil could be used for cooking, as we use today. It could also be used for oil lamps like this, and also for medicinal purposes as an antiseptic, and also as a skin balm for healthy skin. So the way these worked is you would fill this up. And they would use a wick out of fiber or flax, something like that. I'm just using a little bit of twisted paper towel. This is the way it worked. And you might notice on the front cover of your Harmony of the Gospels is an illustration of a lamp like this. Not this, actually that may be the same one. Let me look at that. Yeah, actually this is the same lamp. So this is the way it worked. Now, I haven't filled this with oil, so it'll go out pretty quickly. I just put some oil on the wick, but I'll pass this around and take a look at it, get a feel for what. Yeah, try not to set the classroom on fire here, anybody. But kind of gives you a taste and a little flavor there, and you can see it puts off a fair amount of light. So these would have been placed on shelves in a house in the first century. They would have been, a lot of the houses would have a little niche in the wall, and you would set these up in the niche in the wall. I have seen some of these that are kind of the equivalent of chandeliers. Yeah, a couple of places I've seen kind of chandeliers where these are made, and they may have as many as 20 of these in a ring. Made out of clay or metal, and these would be hung from chains from the ceiling or something and give off the light of 20 of those. So some I've seen are made out of brass or bronze, other metals like that. And these were very, very common. These are also helpful in dating archaeological sites because the styles of the lamps changed over the centuries. Personally have a collection of lamps like this, dating all the way back to Abraham's time, about 4,000 years ago. And so as the styles of the lamps change, they can date archaeological levels by the styles of pottery and the styles of lamps that are found there. Thought that would be interesting. You find lamps and light and so on mentioned time and time again throughout the Bible, and this is what it's talking about there. So kind of gives you a connection there back to biblical times. Yeah, many of you aren't quite as old as certain people in this room when it used to be kerosene lamps. Any of you seen kerosene lamps? Maybe in a grandparent's house, something like that. It used to be, back decades ago when the power would go out, people would have a kerosene lamp. Of course, before they had electrical power, that's what you used was kerosene lamps. Similar to that, just bigger with a glass globe on it to keep the wind from blowing it out. Things like that. So that was the kind of lighting that was used there up until the 60, 70 years ago in a lot of the world. So anyway, thought you'd find that interesting. So again, Matthew 5, verses 14 through 16, this is what Christ is talking about. It's absurd to light a lamp and then set it up on the shelf and put a basket on top of it because it covers up the light. It doesn't do you any good there. But instead, you put it on a lampstand. You put it on an elevated place or a shelf in the house where it illuminates the whole house. and gives light to all who are in the house. And then Christ listened, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. And just quickly recap, we talked about how three different key points we should learn from this. First, that light illuminates. Light illuminates. It shows the way, and like light, we also are to show the light of God's way of life. This just quick recap, talked about this last time, Philippians 2, 14 and 15. Do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. That is what we are supposed to be, as a light to the world. And we talked briefly here also about light brings out the reality of things and illuminates. There, Psalm 119, 105, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. And so I mentioned this is like a first century flashlight. When you were walking along at night, that's what you would use to illuminate your path, illuminate the way. So again, they had these back in David's time, 1000 BC. It was very common. Everybody knew about this. Also, we talked about John 1, verses 4 and 5 and 9. In him, Jesus Christ, was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. That was the true light which gives light to every man coming into the world. So Jesus Christ is the light, the one who gives both life and light, and the true way to live according to God's laws. And then we talked about also briefly that light, a chief characteristic is it is seen and not heard, seen and not heard. So people, when they look at our lives, should see a good example, a good illustration of what it means to live by God's way of life, to be a Christian. Said you might think of our example as being like a lighthouse. A lighthouse gives people direction. So people may not know exactly where they're going and all the chaos and the storms of life. And it's nice to know that there's a lighthouse. So you're not going to run into the rocks. And that's the way we should be toward others. That people can look at us and see somebody who has their act together. Who is living, who has the answers, who knows what life is all about and is living that way. And again, as I mentioned, you can go on our website. You can find whole sermons on the salt of the earth and the light of the world. So just wanted to give us a few quick points about that. So now we come to a key point, and this is where we left off last time, and I stopped a bit early because this is a fairly complex discussion to get into. So I'll pick it up right here. Matthew 5, verses 17 through 20. And this is a pivotal section of the Sermon on the Mount that often gets twisted in every way imaginable, gets turned inside out, upside down, and twisted beyond recognition. So here Jesus Christ says, verse 17, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot and one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." We have a passage here that is very clear to us. So why do so many people get it wrong and actually twist it to mean the exact opposite of what is stated here? Well, the first question to ask about this is why does Jesus Christ even address the subject? Why does this even come up? And the obvious answer is because some people clearly did think that he is annulling or voiding the law in some way. And why would they think this? Well, we've already talked about a number of the confrontations between Jesus and the scribes and the Pharisees, where he ignored their rules and their regulations that they built around the Sabbath day. And they accused him of violating the Sabbath command. Was he violating the Sabbath command? No, he wasn't. He was violating their restrictions, the fence that they had built around the law. And we mentioned some of the commandments or some of their rules and regulations, such as you couldn't spit on the ground on the Sabbath because that is disturbing the soil, which is a form of plowing. Couldn't, if your house is on fire, you couldn't grab up your clothing and take it outside, but you could put on 8 or 10 layers of clothing and go outside. Just picky stuff like that, that were actually making the Sabbath a burden. So yes, Jesus was violating their man-made regulations about the Sabbath, but he was never violating God's intent and purpose regarding the Sabbath day. So in the minds of some people, he was voiding the law. So I think that is why he makes this point here and makes it very clear that he was not coming to do away with the law in any way. So what does he say? Very, very clearly, he says, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets." So what do people think? They think the exact opposite. They think the opposite of what he says. Do not think this. They think he did come to destroy the law. So let's break this down then and see where people get their misconception about what this verse is actually saying. First of all, what does he mean when he says the law and the prophets? Have you discussed this, the three divisions of the Old Testament that have been covered, law, prophets, writings? Okay, so you know that this is, yeah, so he's clearly talking about the books of what we would call the Old Testament, specifically the law, the five books of Moses, and the prophets, referring to the prophetic writings, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and so on, and then the historical writings. And there were, yeah, the three divisions. Sometimes the Old Testament is referred to as just the law, because the five books of Moses began the book. Sometimes, as we see here, it's called the law and the prophets. Sometimes it's called the law, the prophets, and the Psalms, because Psalms was the first book of the writing section. So they're all talking about the same thing, what we would call the Old Testament. I personally don't like the terms Old and New Testament because they never heard those terms. They never used those terms. Those were created only 5-6 centuries ago, something like that. So this is what he's talking about. The Hebrew Bible would be a more accurate way, or the Hebrew Scriptures would be a more accurate way. That's what they would have called it, the Scriptures, the Bible, the Law, the Prophets, the Psalms. That was the terminology they would have used, not the Old Testament. So he says here, "Do not think that I came to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. And whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So where do people make their mistake? So Jesus here is very clearly upholding God's laws. And he says one jot or one tittle of the law won't pass away. And that's referring to, if you've seen Hebrew writing, they have little tiny things that would look like a period or a little squiggle around some of the letters. It would be kind of the equivalent of the dot over the, or the crossing of a T in our letters. That would be sort of the equivalent of that. That's what he's talking about. Just the tiniest parts of what is written in the law will not pass away till all is fulfilled. And he says here also that whoever breaks the law and teaches others that the law doesn't need to be kept will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. And those who uphold it and live by it are going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So again, it's just utterly absurd and backwards to think that Jesus is doing away with the law. So again, what is the mistake they make? They make the mistake in how they interpret this one little word here, fulfill. Fulfill. In English, this word can have the meaning of bringing something to an end. So people assume that this is what Jesus meant, that he's bringing the law to an end by fulfilling it, but it just doesn't work in Greek. The Greek word does not mean that at all. Fulfill in Greek is pleroo, and it means to make full, to fill up, to fill to the full, to render full, to complete, or to fill to the top so that nothing shall be wanting to full measure, to fill to the brim, to consummate, to make complete in every particular, to render perfect. Do you see anywhere in there that it means to abolish or to do away with? No, it simply does not mean that at all. It is used in the Gospels several different times, two ways in particular that illustrate this meaning. One, it's used of filling a fishing net full of fish. If you fill a net full of fish, does that do away with a net? No, it doesn't. It just means you have filled it to the full, to the point of overflowing. It's also used of time, when the time was fulfilled, meaning it has come to pass. The time has been completed for something to be fulfilled. So the basic meaning is simply to fill something to the top, to the point that it's overflowing, or ready to overflow, more precisely, there. So when Jesus says he did not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it, he certainly did that. That his whole life is an example of that. He showed exactly what it means to fully live a life according to God's laws in their full spiritual intent. Another common misconception that you'll hear among other churches is that he came to keep the law for us so we don't have to. And that's another, frankly, asinine way to interpret this. It just makes no sense that he did not come to keep the law so we don't have to. That ignores the whole spiritual intent of the law. God's law is designed to be a blessing to us, to keep us from making mistakes that will harm us, that will harm other people. So to say that Jesus came to do that for us so we don't have to is just a total, complete misunderstanding of the whole purpose and point of the law. He did come to keep the law to show us how we should keep it, but not so that we don't have to keep it. That's just another absurd explanation some people give to try to reason around that. And you might think also about the dozens of examples of remez that we've seen before, because what is the whole point of remez? We've seen again, Matthew uses it, Mark, Luke, John the Baptizer, Jesus Christ, God the Father. The whole point of remez is to point people back to the Old Testament scriptures to draw a parallel or a lesson from it. So the more we actually look into the culture and the background of the Gospels and what we see here in the first century, the more it confirms how much we rely on the laws and the Old Testament there. So again, it's just absurd, the more you understand, to think that Jesus Christ is doing away with all of that. No, he continually points to that as a way for people to live. Yes, Charles.
Conversations with people about the scripture, sometimes they point to the term jot and tittle, and they say, well, you know, you like to pick and choose what you want to keep in the Old Testament. It says right here, jot and tittle, so I guess you have to go sacrifice a lamb at the temple. They say things like things that we don't, do in the church. They say you should be doing because Jesus said jot and tittle about it.
That's actually an excellent point and a deep theological discussion, which you should ask one of the other instructors who has more time, but no. The short answer to that is the laws cover a broad spectrum of life. I mean, the whole point of the law, God giving the law, is to show people how to live. And there were different aspects of that. The sacrifices were part of a system with the temple, with the tabernacle first, then the temple, and a priesthood we cannot offer sacrifices now. And in Israel, this is an ongoing theological debate. And that's why the religious Jews want to establish a temple, because in their minds, their thinking is, without sacrifices, we cannot be cleansed of our sins. So they still have their guilt because they don't have a temple to be able to offer sacrifices, to offer cleansing of sins. And it's very clear that sacrificial system had to be done by a priesthood, had to be done at a designated holy place, which is a temple. So there is no temple, there is no priesthood today. So it can't be done legally according to the instructions that God gave. That's the short answer. Of course, that raises other questions. Why is there going to be a temple established on earth during the millennium, which from Ezekiel is very clear there is? Why? That's been discussed a number of times over the years. To me, the best explanation for that is, at that time, it will serve the same purpose that the sacrifices served for ancient Israel. Because in the millennium, you're still going to be dealing with a lot of unconverted people, as with ancient Israel. And what was the whole point of the sacrificial system? The whole point was to teach the lesson that sin exacts a cost. It leads to death, the death of a sacrificial animal, which, of course, is symbolic of the future, at that time, sacrifice of Jesus, the Messiah, which, of course, is symbolized in the Passover coming up. That Old Testament period, it pointed forward to Christ's sacrifice. In the millennium, I think it's pointing back to Christ's sacrifice to teach an unconverted carnal people the point that sin costs. It has a penalty. It costs a life. So God did a lot of things as teaching and instruction and lessons for us there. And I think that's my explanation. Others may have a different take on it, but I think that's the thing that makes the most sense to me. But yeah, great question there. And you do run into that. Well, why don't you guys keep all the laws? Well, yeah, a lot of them can't be kept according to the full instructions that were done. But we should do the best we can. And that's why it's important to try to understand the spiritual intent. Have you talked about tzitzits in class yet? Has that come up? The tassels on clothing? Has that come up yet? Okay. Land Sabbath, letting the land rest there and things like that. When I came into the church at age 15, we had a large garden about the size of this room here on our property. And we would let that land rest there according to that. And of course, the next year after we didn't plant, yeah, all kinds of things did come up anyway, which you could eat that. God's laws is a very broad subject covering all aspects of life. So we do need to understand the intent and the conditions surrounding the law. So great. Again, long, long discussion. You could spend hours going through that. Let's see. Any other questions about that? All right. So we talked about Remez. The whole point of Remez was to show the meaning and purpose. Yes. Question back there?
I just have a question for the fulfill again. In verse 18, it says, no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled.
Uh-huh.
Yep. And I looked for the Greek word of this, and it's different from the fulfilled there, and it actually shows the end or the to be ended or to be finished or to be done. So what does this refer to then? The law till all is fulfilled. I mean, I know this does not refer to Jesus fulfilling the law at that time, but at what point is this referring to now?
Yeah, great question. I didn't have this in my notes for lack of time, but yeah, you're right. There is a different word for fulfilled there, which does essentially mean that, yes, everything is completed, come to an end, kind of like one of the meanings of the English word fulfilled. Yeah, basically that's talking about the end of God's plan as we know it. We know that there's the 1,000-year period. We know that there's the period of the white throne judgment after that. We know that eventually, as Peter said, the heavens and the earth are going to be burned up. And there's coming a time in God's plan when there will be no more physical earth. There will be no more physical people. And everything is either going to be spirit being, part of God's family, as we understand and know his point and purpose for us to be, there's just going to be that or nothing. At that time, will we need a law that says you have to rest every seventh day? No, because everybody will be spirit. We will not need to rest, whatever that rest means to a spirit being and a spirit existence. Will we need to have a law against lying or stealing or committing adultery or murdering when everyone is spirit beings? We will then have the very character of God and cannot sin. So I think that is what he's talking about. Eventually, Jesus doesn't explain it. Eventually, there's coming a point when in time where there is no more need for laws, because the laws apply to physical human beings, physical existence. So I hope that great question. Hope that answers it there. Again, a lot you could talk about there. Okay, see. Yeah, what also, yeah, continuing here where we were, what does it mean when Jesus says, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, verse 20, you'll by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Kingdom of heaven, incidentally, doesn't mean, talked about this before, we're not going to heaven. Heaven here is used as a synonym for God, because Jesus is not pronouncing God's name there. The problem with the Pharisees is they were, as we'll see in a few more minutes here, is that they were strict for outward religion and righteousness, but their righteousness was an external obedience to the law. It didn't come from the inside, didn't come from a converted heart, a spiritually purified heart. They neglected the weightier matters of the law, Matthew 23. We'll discuss that at some point here. But instead, they focused on the little picky points of the law, again, like spitting on the ground on the Sabbath and that sort of thing. So now, after saying this, now Jesus transitions and contrasts some of the teachings of the scribes and the Pharisees, and contrasting what they taught and what they did with the true spiritual intent of God's law, which required a spiritual dimension that they lacked, that they just did not have and did not understand, because, again, they're carnal, they are unconverted. They don't have God's Spirit. They're not led by God's Spirit. So when Jesus says that he will fill that to the full, that means he is showing the real spiritual intent of the law, the meaning, not just the letter of the law, as the Pharisees understood it, but the spiritual intent. And those are somewhat different things. So, as we'll continue here, six times Jesus says, you have heard it said that, and then he says, but I say to you, or I tell you, and these words make it clear that Jesus is quoting or paraphrasing or summarizing what the scribes and the Pharisees taught, and then by contrast, he explains the true spiritual intent of God's law. So this is how he explains that just doing what the Pharisees did was not enough to gain entrance into the kingdom of God, that we have to go beyond their physical obedience to the letter of the law and live it in its true spiritual intent. So now Jesus transitions into that, starts with an example, verse 21 of Matthew 5, and he contrasts the Pharisees' teaching the real intent of the sixth commandment about murder. And he said, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. Now, so what's wrong with the Pharisees' thinking? Well, their thinking is, so long as you don't actually commit the act of murder, you're okay with God. But Jesus goes on to explain that you can, in a sense, commit murder in your mind, by thinking that person should be killed or doesn't deserve to live, something like that. And that's why he adds here, but I say to you, so he's contrasting what the Pharisees understood with the true spiritual intent of the law, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, which means an idiot, an imbecile, something like that, shall be in danger of the council. Council, apparently the Sanhedrin. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire or Gehenna. Gehenna fire, the lake of fire that completely burns somebody up. I like the way the Good News Bible translates this, makes it a bit clearer. Here it says, but now I tell you, if you are angry with your brother, you will be brought to trial. If you call your brother, you good for nothing, you'll be brought before the council. And if you call your brother a worthless fool, you will be in danger of going to the fire of hell, Gehenna. So what this is talking about is, and this kind of brings it out, kind of a matter of progression in our thoughts about another person. So Jesus, the Pharisees, again, taught that murder was just a matter of taking somebody's life. And Jesus says, no, it's more than that. The commandment actually extends beyond the act itself to just the state of mind or the attitude that leads up to the act. So Jesus says that murder is wrong, but also the kind of anger that prompts the act is equally wrong. So let's follow through. This is actually a sin of progression. So let's say that you become angry with somebody. And that anger, if you don't resolve it, can lead to resentment. There are probably people in our lives we get angry at. And if we don't resolve that, it leads to an attitude of resentment for that person. You just resent his or her existence. You just don't want to have anything to do with them. And eventually you start getting this attitude that they're good for nothing, that they're worthless, they're an idiot, they're just a total waste of good oxygen here. This kind of thing. And this raka, as mentioned here, is an expression of contempt. Not just mad at somebody, but you just find that person contemptible, reprehensible. So what you're doing when you get to that state of mind is you're basically taking on yourself a judgment that really only rightfully belongs to God and to Jesus Christ. You're condemning the person and his or her character. And it's an attitude of condemnation that you're saying this person is worthless and deserves to go to the lake of fire. But that is only God's prerogative. That's not our prerogative. So how do we cut off this progression of thinking in this way about other people? Well, you cut it off as early as possible in that progression. And that's why Paul says in Ephesians 4 and verse 26, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. In other words, if you have something against somebody, don't go to bed and stew about it overnight. Get it done. Get it resolved early. Get it done before sundown that day. Why? Well, because the longer we let it stew and fester, the more that attitude of resentment and viewing somebody as contemptible builds up within us. And Satan can do that. He can get in and let that thought fester in our minds to the point, literally, some people can get so angry that they murder somebody. So stop that process as early as possible. Stop it before the sun sets on that day. The way we combat viewing other people in this way is to first, you have to learn what it is, recognize what's going on in our minds, and to cut it off and replace it with right thoughts and right actions. And that's the key. You understand God's word and God's law, and it may require asking God for his help to forgive others, to forgive the wrong thoughts. And then we start on the road to replacing it with right thoughts. And this again, with Passover coming up in a few weeks, is a big lesson of that. A whole point of Passover is the tremendous sacrifice that Jesus Christ gave so that we could be forgiven. So what right do we have to be condemning of other people, considering how much we have been forgiven? And this is a theme that crops up again and again in the Gospels, that you'll be judged in the same way or by the same standard that we judge others. So if we lack mercy toward others, God is going to lack mercy toward us. On the other hand, if we are merciful, forgiving toward others, that's the standard God is going to use to judge us. And it is a reality of life. If you're always hard, if you're angry, really hard on other people, I've known a few people like that, and they generally live a miserable existence. And what that does to their interpersonal relationships with others. They find it very hard to keep and maintain friendships because they are so harsh and judgmental. Yeah, it just destroys relationships like that. Okay, next one, fairly simple to cover, Matthew 7. Now he gets into the seventh commandment about committing adultery. And he says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell or Gehenna again there. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. So again, the Pharisees' teaching regarding this commandment was only with the physical act, committing adultery. And so they would quote the commandment properly, you shall not commit adultery, that's true. But they missed its point. They missed the point that adultery doesn't begin with a physical act. It begins with the heart, begins with the mind. And that's why Christ makes the point that having that lustful desire in the heart is as wrong as committing the act itself. Now, granted, of course, God designed us, male and female. He designed us to have certain intents and feelings there so that people would want to marry and join and have children and that sort of thing. So the natural desire of itself is not wrong. So some people can go overboard and come to that conclusion. But God is the one who put that desire within us. It's when we let that desire get out of control and start thinking of lustful thoughts, committing adultery or fornication, that's when it starts to become a problem. So it's very important we understand that and control and guard our minds over that. I should also mention here that it was fairly common for rabbis in their teaching in that day to exaggerate something for effect. And Jesus does this as well, because there are times when Jesus says something that, like, unless somebody comes to me and does not hate his mother and father, he cannot be my disciple. Well, I've heard all kinds of tortured reasonings for trying to explain why Jesus would say that. But what he's doing, he's simply exaggerating for effect. And here's a classic example of that. Does Jesus mean that if we are lusting after somebody, we ought to go home and gouge out our eyes? Or if we're tempted to steal, we ought to go home and cut off our hands? No, that's not what he's saying. Unfortunately, over the years, people have taken this literally and done just that. But that is not what Jesus is saying. It is simply a teaching method of exaggerating for effect, to really make people stand up and listen and pay attention. He does not mean that literally, just as he does not mean literally that we should hate our parents if we were to become a follower of hers. So, after all, in committing adultery, is it the eye that's the problem? No, it's not. It's the mind. That's the problem. That's where the sin starts, not in the eyes. With stealing, is it the hand that's the problem because it grabbed something and took it that didn't belong to you? No, it's not the hand that's the problem. It's the mind. It's the heart that's the problem. So Jesus' point is that's where the sin begins, and that's where it needs to stop. It stops with the mind there. And after all, a one-eyed person can still lust just as much as a two-eyed person or a one-handed person can still want to steal as much as somebody with two hands. So again, the issue has to be addressed in the mind, in the heart, in our thoughts. And only by doing that can we really change what we are inside. And how do we combat this? Well, as Paul wrote, 1 Corinthians 6, verses 18 and 19, flee sexual immorality, run away from it. If you find yourself in that kind of circumstance, run away from it. That's what this word flee means, literally run away from it. For every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. And then he explains, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who or which is in you, which you have from God, and you are not your own. The point he goes on to make here is that we have been bought with a price. We've been bought by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So don't even think of, in the context here, he's talking about the city of Corinth, which was a very immoral city with temple prostitution and all of that. I assume you've... Let's go ahead and take our 10-minute break, and we'll get back.